As the Chicago Tribune says, it is always exciting when an acclaimed poet also knows her way around a good story. Mara Stanton is one of that rare breed. That's the end of that quote, as Richard Cecil says. This is me now. Even rarer, it seems to me, is the fiction writer who can write good poems. But Mara Stanton belongs in that rarest of classes, among writers like Robert Penn Warren and Thomas Hardy, who wear both hats equally well and change back and forth with the aplomb, prolificness, and constant surprise of that old, fantastic hat master, Bartholomew Cubbins. Stanton excels equally at stories and verse, prose and poetry, and even on occasion, prose poems. But tonight, I'm told, she'll be wearing her fiction hat. Mara Stanton's new book of stories, Cities in the Sea, was selected by Charles Baxter and Nicholas Del Banco for the 2003 Michigan Literary Award. Though not officially a book of linked stories, the stories are linked by rhyming imagery, by tornadoes, hurricanes, and volcanoes, by recurring themes from both fairy tales and everyday life, but mostly by the way in which we view our everyday lives, and especially how we view the past. In one story, Neptune's Palace, a whole island off the coast of Florida sank in a hurricane, and years later, one character imagines floating over the island as rows and rows of submerged houses and streets, her grandpa's house and her lost childhood, all swim by. A character in a different story sees her lost childhood and her present terrifying fears of tornadoes through a house made almost entirely of glass. And perhaps my favorite story from the collection, Sketching Vesuvius, a Danish painter in 1834, is forced to bear witness to a crime he didn't actually witness, as Hans Christian Andersen guides him through the greatest truths and lessons told in stories, in fiction.
It's also sort of in the spirit of some of my poems, too. It's called Naiads, Sirens, Mermaids, and Nymphs. Somebody's got to set the record straight about who we are. For the last several hundred years, I've been disturbed about the way our kind has been forgotten. Even our names have been assigned to insects or water lilies, or used to describe the inner labia of the vulva or abnormal sexual frenzy. There are still 100 million of us lovely, fabulous creatures around, and only a few of us have scaly tails, only a few of us have wings, and only a few of us have been changed into trees. There's a story that the naiads like to tell, a moral fable, if you will. It seems that one summer day, a handsome mortal was swimming in a freshwater lake somewhere in Italy when a storm blew up. The naiad who nourished that lake was extremely attracted to this mortal's long, muscular thighs and his big shoulders, and although he was about to drown, she swam underneath him and held him up until he reached the shore. Her heart swelled and burned as she watched him clamber to shore, but she knew he was too exhausted and waterlogged to be able to appreciate her if she showed herself to him at that moment. She had to hope that he'd remember that someone had saved him and come back to her lake when he felt stronger. And he did. This was long ago, in the days when you could count on a sacrifice when you helped someone out. And he showed up the next day with a libation of wine. He waded out to pour it on the water, giving thanks to the naiad of the lake. And when she saw those magnificent calves and those dimpled knees, even though she knew it was wrong, she simply couldn't bear it any longer. She rose up from the water, visible, wearing only a skimpy little camisole and a thong, and held out her arms. But his mouth fell open. He started to back away. "Who are you?" he asked as she came closer. "I'm in love with you. I'm the naiad of this lake," she said, knowing that she was risking her eternal youth for this human, but unable to stop. "No, you're not," he cried. "Where's your tail? You're just trying to trick me into marriage. You're probably a witch." And he flung the wine in her face and turned to run. Oh, that story went the rounds, and it's still going the rounds even today when naiads have all but been forgotten, and you mortals play with blow-up mermaid toys in swimming pools while a naiad sits invisibly on the edge, her gorgeous legs crossed, disdainfully painting her nails lavender. The first thing you have to understand is that we are all, each and every one of us, a nymph, just as each and every one of you is a mortal. Just as your own nature as a mortal requires you to grow old and ugly if you don't die young, the nature of nymphs allows us to remain always youthful and beautiful, provided we don't cross the gods. But that doesn't mean all nymphs are alike. Some nymphs are immortal and some aren't. Triads, for example, live in forests, and when their own special tree dies or is cut down, they wither away at the same moment, even if they happen to be somewhere else at the time. The airy limoniads live only a season, flitting among meadow flowers. Other nymphs don't like to befriend them because it's so sad. And naiads and nereids, often confused with one another, are physically unlike. Naiads, who live in streams, lakes, rivers, springs, fountains, and swimming pools, are proud of their long, shapely legs and are famous for stealing any pair of sandals or high heels they can get their hands on. If you leave a new pair of pretty slides on the side of the pool when you jump in, and they're gone when you climb back out, you can assume the naiad of the pool simply helped herself. And although naiads get emotionally upset at boating accidents, that won't stop them from snatching a pair of attractive shoes belonging to a victim, which is why so many of the female corpses that divers find are barefoot. Nereids, on the other hand, like to flaunt their shimmering multicolored tails, decorating them with shells and gemstones. However, they are gifted with the power to metamorphose into creatures with legs at will, and each one has a hidden sea cave full of marvelous shoes for those occasions. There are only 50 of them, all daughters of Nereus and Taurus. You used to find them mainly in the Mediterranean, but so many oil tankers have been cleaning their holes between Egypt and Crete these days that some have gotten fed up and migrated to other, cleaner oceans, and a few have chosen to totter around in France. Nereids love scarves and capes and cloaks. They love to wrap silk and chiffon around their elegant throats or throw bolts of velvet around their shoulders. I'm sorry to say that the Nereids, perhaps because of their power to change into human form, look down on the Oceanids. There are 3,000 Oceanids, all of them daughters of Oceanus and Tethys, and they are notable for the lovely turquoise scales on their simple fish tails. They are sweet and gentle, and so shy that they seldom surface, more interested in their own fascinating but ordered society below the water than the chaos on land. One thing I'd like to make clear before I continue. Nereids and Oceanids, who prefer invisibility, are not mermaids, even though they have fish tails. Mermaids are large, noisy, blonde, asthmatic beings, part woman, part fish, who come from cold northern waters. They're chilly creatures, always knitting sweaters out of seaweed and drinking hot cuttlefish ink instead of nectar. They can't make themselves invisible, which is why sailors are always sighting them on rocks, sunning their cold silver scales. Why you mortals confuse mermaids with sirens is something of a mystery. I've seen postcards of some large gilt-frame paintings that hang in art galleries, for nymphs love to send arty cards to each other with little notes on the back in green or purple ink. Sirens are portrayed as busty women with fishtails beached on rocks or swimming up to boats, mouths open like opera divas. Once I even got a postcard from Australia that showed a painting where 6 or 7 eagles with human faces are flying around Odysseus, who is tied to a mast, and his muscles are straining against the ropes. It's a nice painting, but for heaven's sake, those are harpies, not sirens. The truth is, there are only three sirens. Their father was the oldest son of Oceanus, and their mother was the muse Calliope. Although classified as sea nymphs, they are mostly women and only part bird, with fantastic blue and purple wings attached to their shoulder blades. But the wings are merely decorative. Like chickens, they can't fly more than a few feet. Who have I left out? Oh, the Hyades, of course, but they were turned into stars so long ago they hardly count. And the Oreads, who hang around with the goddess Diana, as well as all the other assorted fundamentalist nymphs who serve Apollo, Poseidon, and the other gods. Those are the nymphs who grumble about atheists in all the new monotheistic religions. They're always talking about the good old days when 300 sheep or 200 cattle would be sacrificed for their god, and they lean over the clouds, inhaling the barbecue smoke. They still wear short little tunics and lace their sandals up their muscular calves and carry a bow and arrow as if this weren't the 21st century. They're the ones who did this terrible thing to me. Once, long ago, I was the naiad of a small lake in Minnesota, fringed with willows and birches. I used to swim with otters, and I got on a first-name basis with many generations of the raccoon family that built a dam across my narrow part. Then humans showed up in my corner of the world, and that was fine too. I watched handsome fellows canoe across my placid surface. I let them fish. I let young women admire themselves in my placid pools. Occasionally I fell in love, but I've been warned about the danger of losing my eternal youth from the other nymphs. And I also remember that story I told you, the one about the mortal who'd been frightened rather than delighted when the naiad revealed herself to him. So I kept my distance from humankind, occasionally frolicking with fawns, and sometimes one of the gods, as was their nature, snuck down from Olympus, and we had a night of rapturous sex. I'm not sure when I noticed that my lake was starting to dry up, but suddenly there were muddy pools along my lush green banks, and ball patches appeared here and there. Algae thickened in my waters, and lilies floated in thick patches, their long snake-like stems preventing humans from swimming or boating. At first I didn't mind, for I rather liked the silence, and I thought some heavy rain would get me back into shape. But a drought kicked in, and pretty soon my banks were swampy and foul-smelling, and even though I liked the fuzzy cattails that grew up, I was bothered by the thickening clouds of mosquitoes and gnats. So I resigned myself to being the naiad of a swamp. But as I looked around my old neighborhood, I saw human habitations coming closer and closer, and one day, I realized that I was being drained for a subdivision. So this is how it ends, I thought, curled up in the last bit of mud in the center of my former lake as I watched the bulldozers at work across the new fields. Then another naiad, a friend I hadn't seen for a century or two, stopped by. She was wearing a lacy beach top over a bikini, an ankle bracelet, and mirrored sunglasses, and she prodded me with her foot and gave me some good news. The humans were building swimming pools. She told me I should hurry up and claim any nearby pool that contained a drop or two of my old water, like all the other naiads in these parts. She herself had chosen a pool behind a big house on 4 acres and assured me that a concrete or fiberglass basin was a good place to get away from the mud and mosquitoes. "Where did you get that great outfit?" I asked her. She grinned. "They built a new shopping center just over there. I helped myself." "What do the gods say about all this?" She shrugged. "I don't think the gods are paying much attention to us anymore. So why should we be sticking the muds?" I chose a swimming pool at the house closest to my former right bank. The first afternoon, I sat on the aqua blue ledge, dangling my feet over the edge, getting used to the smell of chlorine. I was feeling depressed, and instead of presiding over a lake in a woodland full of singing birds, I only had this smelly bathtub. Then a couple came out of the sliding glass doors, a young blonde and a handsome dark-haired fellow, a little older than her. A short woman with a clipboard in her hand followed them. "Isn't this pool great?" the short woman said. "Can't you just imagine sitting out here on a summer night? And that's a green belt back there. The land slopes down and can't be developed." Said the blonde. She had curly hair with a cute butterfly clip holding it back on the right side in a tight halter top that would have just fit me, too. Her lips were thick and petulant, and she moved briskly, dissatisfied. "But isn't that swampland out there? I bet there are lots of mosquitoes." "You bet," I said, "and they'll eat you alive." But of course, she couldn't hear me. "We could spray," the man said. "We could just stay inside and never use the pool," the woman snapped back. "But then why buy a house with a pool?" "I thought you wanted to swim laps." "I do. Oh, this house hunting is wearing me out. You're all starting to look alike. I've got a headache." "I'm sorry, honey. Want to go back to the motel?" "No, we've got to decide." She began to walk briskly around the pool, eyeing it balefully. The man sighed and turned in my direction. He ran his hands through his hair. He had high cheekbones, sad dark eyes, and a sensitive mouth. He was tall and thin, almost willowy, not the kind of man that used to drive me crazy back in the golden days. But there was something about him, a reserve, a gentleness that appealed to me just then. I didn't think the blonde deserved him. "There's one other house over on Meadowbrook I want to show you," the real estate agent said. "Let's go," the blonde said. "Come on, Jason, one more. Then we'll go back to the motel and get Mom and the kids. They must be starving." I watched them go back into the house. So his name was Jason, like the famous hero of the Argonauts. I slipped down into the water of my new pool, floating on my back for a while, thinking about him, wishing I could see him in his swimming trunks. I imagined what it might be like to swim beneath him in the pool, pressing up against his body as he stroked from one end to the other. I didn't expect to ever see him again, so I let myself go, dreaming about him, and when I touched my inner thighs, they were trembling. But the next day, he was back. I was napping on the bottom when I heard a splash, and when I swam up, I saw my dreamy Jason and the blonde wearing a terrific pair of black Italian sandals with little straps, staring into the water. They had two children with them, a boy and a girl, and an older woman with curly red hair who must have been the blonde's mother. At first, I didn't know what was going on, and then I figured out that the boy child had just tossed a piece of leftover ceiling tile into the pool, and his mother was scolding him. "This is going to be our pool," she told him. "Don't ever do that again. It costs a lot to keep a pool clean." "I just don't know why you want a swimming pool, honey," her mother said. "This is Minnesota, not California. You won't be able to use it all winter." "Just look at this place Jason got transferred to, Mom. It's a nowhere state in the middle of the Midwest, which is already nowhere. If I can't at least go for a swim in the summer, I'll die. And this is a house with the biggest walk-in closet." My Jason had his daughter by the hand, and he led her around the pool. I could tell he was happy. He showed his daughter my shallow end and my aluminum steps. Then he pointed off to the swamp. "There's the nature reserve," he told her. "We can go for walks back there." He pointed up at the blue sky. "We should be able to see some stars at night." It was another 2 weeks before I had the delicious pleasure of swimming alone with him. First, the moving van showed up, and even from the pool, I could hear the whole family running around, shouting at each other as they unpacked. The kids crying about how they couldn't find this or that toy. The blonde yelling at Jason to come help hang a picture or unwrap the dishes or go back to the store for the other kind of something. The blonde's mother, who only stayed the first week, kept a strict eye on the kids for an hour each afternoon that she let them splash around in my shallow end, which I appreciated. And I stayed well away from them, curled up by the drain. But as soon as they all had the house in order, the blonde herself started coming out every morning to swim her laps, as she called them, and I had to put up with her thrashing back and forth. Sometimes I rested on the bottom, watching her energetic bulk pass overhead, tempted to grab her by the ankle and pull her under just for a joke. Not that I had any intention of drowning her, but all that blustery self-confidence in the water. She'd won a couple of swimming medals in college, big deal. Got under my skin, and in the following days, I helped myself to a pretty pair of pink sandals, a lacy shirt, and a sarong skirt. The blonde had great clothes, and I fantasized about breaking into her walk-in closet, but I was too timid to leave the pool area. Then, one humid July night, after he got home from work, my Jason decided to go for a swim, and for the first time, I saw his bare back and thin but muscular chest and his shapely legs. He wasn't a good swimmer. He heaved himself from the shallow end to the deep end and back again, and then just let himself float in the water, his eyes closed, his breathing slow and content. I got right underneath him, pressing up like a cushion of water, stroking his shoulders and running my fingers down his spine to the elastic band of his baggy nylon trunks. I could have slid them off, but I was afraid to startle him or make him wary. I wanted his experience in the water with me to be pleasurable so that he'd return again and again. Gently, I swelled back and forth over his legs. I lapped his neck, ran my fingers through his silky wet hair, and kept out of his eyes. All of a sudden, splash, she jumped in. She swam huskily toward him, and I had to crouch way below the surface to avoid her chopping legs. She grabbed one of his feet and pulled him under, and then kissed him as he surfaced, sputtering and choking. "Sweetheart," she said, "I'm sorry for what I said in there." He coughed up some chlorine, nodding. He tried to swim away from her, but she grabbed his shoulder. "Listen," she said, "if Mom takes the kids to L.A. with her for a month, we can do naughty things out here." "I told you," he sputtered, treading water as he faced her. "I don't want to lose the kids for that long. A week, maybe, not a month." "Well, you're the one who works all day," she said, swimming over to the side and pulling herself up on the edge. "What about me, stuck out here in the suburbs in a place where the neighbors steal your clothes? You said we can't afford daycare unless I got a job, but the only job I could get around here is at Walmart. My whole salary would go into daycare." I didn't want to hear anymore. I swam down to my favorite corner and listened to the soothing sound of the water filter. When I came up several hours later, the sky was full of stars. The blonde must have won the argument. The children disappeared, but the promised naughtiness never happened. She continued her furious morning swims, but all she left on the lawn chair was an old towel and a pair of battered shower shoes that I wouldn't have touched with a 10-foot snake. Occasionally in the evening, when my Jason got home from work, they brought drinks outside and sat side by side in lawn chairs. He was obviously tired and sighed a lot. A few times he tried to tell her something about what was going on at work, and I strained up out of the water to listen, but she cut him off quickly. She wasn't interested in what he had to say. She chattered about new curtains, a theater group she had joined, a friend she'd gone to lunch with, the magnet school where the kids would be bused in the fall. Once she kicked off her open-toed shoes, but before I could snatch them away, she smelled something burning in the kitchen and put them back on. Then it was September. My pool was drained and a plastic cover installed. I was reduced to a few frozen drops in the drain, but that was enough to sustain me until the summer. The potted geraniums withered. Dried leaves blew around the patio. At first I dozed in the lawn chair, But then they took the lawn furniture inside too, and I had to sleep in a corner by the fence under a pile of leaves. Sometimes the children who were back home ran out to play in the yard, but the gate to the pool area was locked, and no one disturbed me. I only saw Jason once, blowing leaves around with a leaf blower. The winter seemed endless, and I lost track of the comings and goings of the whole family. The house was dark for a few days in February, as if no one were home. But by then, I was a wavering, dehydrated shadow of myself, in no shape to notice anything except my own shrunken blue fingernails. To keep myself going, I reminded myself of the old days when a cozy, thick sheet of ice would form on top of my beloved lake like a magical ceiling, and I'd swim just below it, delighted by the way the sunlight fell through the translucent panes. Sometimes a fisherman cut a hole in the ice, and when he was gone, I'd slip up and go skating across my own frozen surface. I remember the wind blowing through my hair as I rushed about, admiring the snow-shaked pine trees around my shore. I'd wave to the Hyades, and it didn't matter if they ignored me. I was so happy. Who wanted to be a star when you could live in a lake as beautiful as mine? I admit, I was feeling extremely sorry for myself. I'd never been that low before, down to a few dribbles of myself. I confess, I thought of evaporating. Then one morning in early May, when a warm front had moved up from the south and the air had turned balmy, the sliding glass doors opened for the first time in months. Jason came outside with a cup of coffee and began to pace back and forth in his bathrobe, talking to a friend on a cell phone. I stirred gently in the dead leaves, rustling closer, and though I only caught one half of the conversation, I understood that the blonde had left him. She'd taken the children and wanted a divorce. He was sad, he was distraught, he was angry, he was on the verge of a nervous breakdown. These were phrases he used to his friend. I looked at his gaunt, grief-stricken face. I looked at his lovely knees below the short terry cloth robe. Why, he was handsomer than ever. I felt my whole body tremble, and all at once I realized that the ice in the pipes had melted and I was flowing again. I had the power to reveal myself to him at that very moment, but I remembered the story of the naiad in Italy. I didn't want my handsome mortal to throw a cup of coffee in my face and run back inside and call the police about a female intruder. I had to plan carefully, even though I was desperate, for unlike the disappointed Italian naiad, who'd kill the handsome mortal when he threw the wine in her face, perhaps I forgot to mention that, I had no lovely lake to return to if my overture failed. So that evening, just as he was pulling into the driveway after work, I materialized in front of his bumper and fell to the pavement. He thought he'd hit me. He stopped the car, jumped out in horror, and grabbed my arm as I struggled to rise. I stood there rubbing my hip, whimpering a little. I knew I looked good. All I was wearing was his wife's sarong, her see-through lace shirt, and the pink sandals. Are you all right? My God, I didn't see you. I gave him a wan smile. Perhaps if I could rest for a moment. I feel shaken up right now. Of course, he said excitedly. Come into the house. Do you want me to call someone? Do you live around here? He opened the front door with his key and helped me inside. The foyer was two stories high with a staircase going up and a big chandelier hanging down from the ceiling. He took me into the living room on the left and settled me on a long white sofa, very much like the ones I imagined the gods used up on Olympus. I'll just park the car, he said. I left it running when I jumped out. I'll be right back. This was my first time in a human habitation, so I looked around with great curiosity. The floor covering was soft, nappy wool, and the table in front of the sofa was glass with brass corners. Some kind of votive offering of dried flowers stood on the table beside the figurine of a shepherdess. There was also a photograph of Jason's two children, the girl and the boy. in a metal bowl filled with dried triangles of corn. I tasted one of the triangles while I was waiting, and it crackled in my mouth. Jason returned quickly, still flushed and concerned about me. I had my story ready. I had just left my husband, I explained, after a terrible quarrel, and I was never going back there. I'd been so upset I hadn't seen his car. It was all my fault, but I was so shaken up I didn't think I could move from his sofa. Was it all right if I stayed there that night? Otherwise, I'd have to go to a motel. Of course I could stay, but didn't I want to call my husband? No, no, never, I said. My marriage was over. He nodded. His marriage was over, too. He made me a curious drink with salt around the rim and told me that the strange triangles were taco chips. He brought out some fresh ones with a burning tomato sauce. He started talking about the blonde and his children, and I murmured soothingly and arranged my legs attractively. I leaned toward him. All nymphs have a perfume breath laced with pheromones, so it wasn't long before our lips touched. He was lonely and desperate for love. So was I. His bed felt lumpy and unyielding compared to my lovely water, but we made love as well as we could once I had gotten rid of the silly sheets. He wasn't used to so much pleasure, and he moaned and thrashed. It was a long time before I could soothe him to sleep, but finally he was breathing gently, and I kissed his eyelids. I couldn't sleep myself, for I was excited by my new life and a little scared, too. Once I got up and went to the window, I could have sworn I saw a nymph out there, a frowning Oread with laced-up sandals and winged shoulders, who put her finger to her mouth and shook her head, reminding me of the fate awaiting naiads who try to cross over to the human world. But I told myself I was just imagining her because I was anxious and guilty, though there was nothing to be guilty about. I was just trying to survive. In the morning, Jason didn't want to go to work. He wanted to lie in bed and drink coffee and make love all day. But I made him go. "I'll be waiting for you," I said. And I asked him if I could borrow some of his wife's clothes because I didn't want to go home just yet. "Sure," he said, "take anything she's left behind." I trembled with excitement. After so many centuries of nudity, of ducking myself in ferns or water lily leaves, with only an occasional stolen pair of moccasins or a left-behind shawl or buckskin skirt, and maybe later a Cubs baseball cap or a pair of black satin bikini underpants stolen from a teenage girl who was making love on my bank, I wanted to deck myself in lots and lots of human finery. But when I finally stepped into the walk-in closet, I was taken aback. The blonde had already packed up her good clothes, leaving behind only a pair of jeans with frayed legs, a plaid flannel shirt, some battered running shoes, a shapeless sweater, a long out-of-fashion op-art polyester miniskirt, and a white silk blouse with sweat stains under the arms. I looked at myself in the full-length mirror. What I had on was just fine. The lacy shirt revealed my breasts, the pink sandals set off my gorgeous legs, and the sarong hung gracefully on my hips. But Jason had already seen me in this outfit. I needed something else to delight him when he got home from work. Then I remembered the naiad who'd visited me in the mud. She'd mentioned that she got her clothes at a nearby shopping center. I went into the kitchen and found a black plastic garbage bag. The next thing I knew, I had materialized inside Bare Essentials, a classy dress shop that sold wedding gowns, evening gowns, diaphanous nightgowns, and sexy underwear. The shop opened at 10 a.m., so I had to hurry. First, I chose a tight pink slinky dress with rhinestone straps and a pair of high heels with matching rhinestone ankle straps. I scooped up a blue velvet number and a little light knit thing made of gold. I snatched some purple satin underwear off a table and a bunch of earrings off a rack. Then I spotted the wedding dresses, and that was my undoing. The wedding dresses had seated pearl bodices and flowing satin skirts. Some had tight puckered sleeves, the kind princesses used to wear. Others had sleeves like little bells or puffs of organdy. They were dresses like women wore in paintings or in fairy tales, and I just couldn't decide. I kept grabbing one and then another and then putting them back when I saw the flutter of some other filmy sleeve or scalloped hem. But finally, I chose one of ivory lace. And just as I was stuffing the beautiful dress into the plastic garbage bag, the police arrived. The Oread I saw last night wasn't a dream. She was warning me that I'd gone too far, that I was about to lose my powers. I stood there with a plastic bag, unable to move, like a figure frozen in a dream. They clapped handcuffs on my wrists, and though I closed my eyes and conjured up Jason's bedroom and then the empty swimming pool, I was still being dragged out the back door of the dress shop to a waiting squad car. Now it appears that I've lost my eternal youth, too. There's a sheet of metal bolted over the sink here in my cell at the jail, and I can see the fine lines beginning to appear around my eyes and mouth. The handcuffs left a bruise on my wrist, and my arm is scratched from my one futile attempt to break away from the strong rookie female cop who was pushing me into the back seat. So I know I've lost any chance at immortality, too. I share this cell with three other women, and we're all dressed alike in shapeless blue overalls. Carol's in here for writing bad checks because she lost her job and couldn't pay for groceries anymore. Mavis got stopped for going through a red light. She got obstreperous when they tried to give her a breathalyzer test. She's under a lot of stress because her kid died of an overdose last month. And Linda shot her husband. He was beating her up, and she only wounded him in the cheek, but he was the one who filed the charges. And I'm in here for breaking into a dress shop. Who are you? The police keep asking me, for I have no purse, no wallet, no ID. I gave them the address of my former lake, but they only laughed. They've never heard of naiads. They tell me they've located someone who claims he's my ex-husband, and he's given me a local habitation and a name. He says I'm 41, that I'm bipolar, that he has custody of our two children, that I've made phone calls threatening his new wife, that I've stolen some of her panties off the clothesline, that I must have stopped taking my medication. I'm not a nymph, he says. I'm not a naiad either, whatever the hell that is. But Carol and Mavis and Linda, they believe me. They lean forward on their narrow bunks, listening, nodding, and remembering. Thank you.